set in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Where are we going? Where do we come from? Okay, I hear you, our listeners, saying, come on, Connection. You don't expect us to have answers for that. But today is the story of cosmic history, and the Hubble telescope has been writing it for us for years. Since 1990, this observatory floating in space has done more than anything else to answer the big questions of our world. How old is the universe? How do stars die? Hubble gave us our best ever image of Mars. It showed us Comet Shoemaker colliding with planet Jupiter. Awesome. You'd think Hubble was worth keeping. But it's getting old, and NASA is putting energy and money into a new telescope. The James Webb is set to be in space by 2001. So Hubble will die like a star in the sky in 2010. But should we let it go? No, say a lot of scientists and amateur astronomers. They protested so passionately, Congress has asked NASA to re-examine its plans. Connection listeners, have images from the Hubble enriched your understanding of our universe? Are you interested in the world beyond planet Earth? What is the price of discovery? And should publicly funded projects like space telescopes serve only to advance science? Or should it be part of their mission to inspire us in the public as well? Our number to call, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Well, Connection listeners, we want you to soar today. We want to take you to places you've never been before. So if you're listening to this program in front of your computer, just click on www.theconnection.org, and there you're going to find an amazing world of pictures, spiral galleries, curtains of light, awesome images, and that is what Hubble brought to all of us. Do take a look while you're listening to the program. I tell you, it's worth it. Well, our guests are worth it too. Joining us first on the line to talk about the Hubble and these extraordinary images, Rick Feinberg, editor-in-chief of Sky and Telescope magazine. Welcome, Rick.
Good morning, Lise. Thanks for having me.
Now, I don't have to tell you that those pictures are pretty amazing. Tell me, which one do you find most awesome of all?
Well, I haven't logged into your website yet, but I've got most of the Hubble images committed to memory since I've seen them all so many times. My favorites are the close-ups of dusty spiral galaxies where you can see all kinds of star formation regions in red and dust in black and brown and bright blue stars all modeling the spiral arms. And my next favorite is the Hubble Deep Field, which shows thousands of galaxies in a speck of sky that earlier telescopes had shown to be essentially empty.
My goodness. Well, let's hope all the number of our listeners are joining in with you now. Rick, I understand that you testified at NASA's public meeting on July the 31st. What did you tell them about Hubble and why it should stay?
Well, when I first saw who was going to be testifying, I realized that it was all NASA officials and professional astronomers. And I thought it was important that the view of the general public and amateur astronomers, who are arguably the most supportive of astronomy in the public, should be heard as well. So I went down to Washington to tell them that the science is not the only part of the story. After all, the Hubble Space Telescope is a publicly funded project. It's funded by our tax dollars. And we get a lot more out of it than just scientific discoveries. For the general public and for students and for teachers, there's a lot of inspiration and a lot being done in education with images from Hubble. And I thought it was important that the committee understand that if they allowed the program to wind up somewhat prematurely, that they would be hurting more than just the science, but they might actually be hurting future generations of scientists and students.
Well, when you got there with that gathering of all those scientists, what did you find that they were most bothered about?
I think the biggest concern is that there is nothing on the drawing board today that will replace Hubble's current capabilities or any of Hubble's planned capabilities. The next space telescope that you referred to, the James Webb Space Telescope, is primarily going to operate at infrared wavelengths. These are colors of light, if you will, that are redder than the reddest color that we can see. The Hubble Space Telescope works at some of these wavelengths, but is primarily working in the visible and in the ultraviolet, which are shorter, higher energy wavelengths. And the James Webb Space Telescope will not work at those wavelengths. And so if Hubble is allowed to end its mission before the James Webb Space Telescope is flying, suddenly astronomers will be blind at visible wavelengths from orbit. Now, that's not to say they won't be able to see the visible universe, because, of course, there are all kinds of ground-based telescopes that can see it, but they can't see it nearly as sharply. And so much of astronomy is done today with telescopes that operate all across the spectrum. It would be a shame if suddenly there was a big gap in the visible and ultraviolet.
Well, we'll hear more in the program about whether it will be a shame. I have to give you a bit of publicity, Rick. I understand you have an asteroid named after you. 9983 Rick Feinberg. That's an original title for an asteroid. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, the conversation continues because I'm going to welcome now Robert Kirshner, who kindly came into the studio today without a telescope, I have to say. He is the Robert Clues Professor of Science at Harvard University, and he works in the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. I think you're one of those scientists that Rick Feinberg was talking about.
Yes, I am, and I was at that meeting.
Well, but we're not connectionless. We're just going into the realm of science. We're going in extra fields. We're also going to that area where art meets science, and a day at the planetarium for your kids, because Jim O'Leary is joining us. He's the Senior Director of Technology for the IMAX Planetarium at the Maryland Science Center in Baltimore. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Lise. Nice to be here.
It is fun to be here.
Nice and fun. Scientists have fun. Well, Robert,
yes.
Just tell us what was fun about Hubble. What did it do for science? We heard from Rick Feinberg what it did for all of the amateur astronomers.
Right. Well, the Hubble Space Telescope is the first big astronomical telescope in space. And that means it's above the Earth's atmosphere, which, of course, the atmosphere is a very fine thing, but not for astronomy. The atmosphere absorbs some wavelengths of light, and it distorts all the wavelengths of light.
So it blurs the images.
It blurs the images. And, you know, when you look through a telescope from the ground, the images, the stars seem to dance around a little bit. That's the atmosphere at work. If you're above the Earth's atmosphere, then you can make a telescope which is limited only by the perfection of its optics and the limits of physics. Now, the Hubble Space Telescope was kind of a tragicomic story at first, where the telescope was launched and didn't work. It was made perfectly, but to the wrong shape. And it took a set of contact lenses brought up by astronauts to get it back on track. But since that first servicing mission, the telescope has been working beautifully. And in subsequent servicing missions, astronauts have gone up in the shuttle, rendezvoused with the space telescope, and put new instruments into the telescope. So each time they've done that, the power of the telescope has really increased quite a bit.
But Hubble has becomes almost like a person. People love the Hubble story. What does Hubble look like?
Well, I don't know exactly what it looks like now. It's probably a little bit beat up on the outside. But inside, according to one of the astronauts who was at the meeting last week, it's very, very clean. They've been able to replace some of the instruments, put new ones in. The telescope does things now that it couldn't do when it was first built, and it's working on problems.
Come on, you're avoiding the question. Like, most of us think of a telescope,
something
in the backyard, a long sort of cylinder.
Yeah, it's a...
But is that what it's like,
yeah,
one of these things
big,
floating up in space, or
yeah,
is it a platform with...
No, it's a big can. It looks like a big can with a couple of wings, which are the solar panels that are pointed at the sun to make electrical power to run the whole thing. It's beautiful.
You just don't want to share your secrets. You don't want to tell us.
Well,
Jim O'Leary.
I've never had a chance to go up there.
I've got to bring in someone from the planetarium.
He has
Jim O'Leary,
pictures of it.
Tell us first what you do and how you use the Hubble in making science come alive for the people who visit you.
Well, we're at a public science museum at Baltimore's Inner Harbor, the Maryland Science Center. And with the Space Telescope Science Institute here in town, they are the folks that operate the science missions on board Hubble. So they're neighbors, and because of that, we've become the visitor center for the Hubble Space Telescope. So we have a lot of exhibitry and programs, planetarium programs and otherwise, on Hubble, its discoveries, its legacy, why it's important, what it's shown us, and how it's changed our understanding of how the universe is made up and where it's come from and perhaps where it's going.
Tell us about something which maybe for children and even adults made Hubble come alive. Eagle Nebula is described as the poster child for Hubble. What is it?
The Eagle Nebula, it's probably on your site. I'm not looking at it right now, but that's one of those highlight images that has been on posters.
It is on
and
our site, yes.
Astronomy books. It is, good. And
it's extraordinary, too, I have to say.
It's a screensaver. You can find it almost anywhere. And it was a dramatic image from, I think it was 1995 or thereabouts. And it's from a constellation in the summer sky that amateur astronomers are familiar with. And the nebula itself is an object that is visible from Earth and slightly resembles an eagle in flight. If you use your imagination a little bit, you know, that you always need that when you're looking at constellations or these nebulas with names attached to them. And it's at the heart of this Eagle Nebula. Amateur astronomers and ground-based photographs have often seen these three, you can call them pillars, that were vaguely present in these ground-based images. A couple of astronomers decided to take a close look at that with one of Hubble's cameras back in the mid-90s. And it revealed some fascinating science about things we had guessed about for a long, but it was one of these, oh my goodness, kind of pictures. It was just astounding. It's been sometimes called the pillars of creation. And it's three towers, three gaseous columns of gas that are actually being blown away by a very energetic star that's just outside the field of view of the Hubble image. And inside these columns of gas, there are stars in the process of formation. That's where stars form in these giant nebulas of dust and gas, similar to the way our solar system formed 5 billion years ago. So this could be a look back at how our solar system might have formed long, long ago. But what's happening is that this star is actually blowing away the cocoon of gas and dust that forms these stars and perhaps around them planetary systems like ours. And it's really robbing these stars and any possible planets that are there of the material they need to fully form. So it's kind of destroying this cocoon of gas that surrounds the cloud. So there's a lot of things going on in the image.
Indeed.
But it's just a absolutely beautiful, stunning picture, which I think is what people think about when they see a lot of these images. There's lots of wonderful science, lots of wonderful revelations, and many more questions that these images raise, but many of them are true works of art and stunning images on their own.
Much better than standing on the ground and singing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. What would happen if Hubble goes? Will you mourn its passing?
I would, yes. It's become perhaps a favorite child of many in the astronomy community and in among the public. It started off, as Robert was saying early on, as a near disaster. So it's sort of like the prodigal son. It's come back from the brink of almost uselessness when it was first launched. And it has truly redeemed itself and gone far beyond that. And if you think of all the things NASA does, I mean, there are a couple of things that I would guess the general public might think about. Of course, the space shuttle and the astronaut crew, which is unfortunately in a lull right now, but will return to space probably next year. There are a number of people that have heard about the International Space Station, the fact that it is populated now by two astronauts and has been that way for a number of years. It's actually, we just passed the 1,000th day of permanent habitation of the International Space Station. But that's probably not as well known. I know a number of people who come to the Science Center at our place in Baltimore are surprised that there is a permanently occupied space station orbiting the Earth. They've heard about it, but the idea that there are people always there doing things is not well known. But what I'm leading to, I think, is the Hubble Space Telescope is probably, after the shuttle program, the most recognizable facet of what NASA does. And it is certainly a good story. It is this recovering from the brink of disaster, wonderful images, something new showing up in the newspapers every week or every month.
Well, it's a story that certainly deserves to continue. We are going to continue it here on The Connection because we're talking now about images from the Hubble Space Telescope, how they've advanced science and inspired the rest of us. Should it be the mission of taxpayer-funded science projects like the Hubble to inspire all of us? Our number, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Lise Doucette in for Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Lise Doucette. This is The Connection. This hour, we're talking about the Hubble Space Telescope. What would be lost if its mission ends in 2010, as is the plans of NASA? With me in the studio is Robert Kirshner. He's the author of The Extravagant Universe. And joining us from WYPR in Baltimore is Jim O'Leary. He works at the Maryland Center's Science Center's Planetarium, and he hosts WYPR's program Skywatch. And a reminder to all of us, you can view some of the extraordinary images of the Hubble on our website, www.theconnection.org. Please join us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Robert Kirshner, how old is the universe? That's one of the big questions that Hubble is said to have answered for us.
Well, the short answer is it seems to be about 13.7 billion years old, give or take a few hundred million. And, of course, the real question, or the most interesting thing, is the bigger question that the universe really has a past, has a future, and that we can know the past and predict the future. A telescope measures light, and light travels at the speed of light, which in ordinary life means real fast. But for astronomers, it's the slowness of light that gives us a kind of historic reach. It means if you go out at night and you look at stars, the light took time to get here. So you see the stars not the way they are, but the way they were back when the light left. So, for example, if you go out tonight and you see some stars in our own Milky Way galaxy, the light might have taken a few hundred years to get here. So the light left when, for example, the Federalists controlled both houses of Congress. But the with small telescopes, you can see millions of light years away. And with the Hubble Space Telescope, we can see billions of light years away.
So it's transformed the way we look or are able to look at the universe.
Well, we knew that there were these distant objects, but the Hubble Space Telescope gives us a much sharper look at them and allows us to see individual stars in distant galaxies, to measure the distances. That's one of the things that the space telescope was designed to do, and it did it. What's more interesting is that there are also things that we didn't think of when the space telescope was being designed and built that are things that have turned out to be really interesting. For example, tracing the history of cosmic expansion, we thought that gravity would be slowing things down. But what we found, and Hubble played an important role in this, is that the universe seems to be speeding up over time as if there's a dark energy that's just bursting with the kind of snapping power that makes the universe speed up. And this is a very mysterious and new thing.
What is that? And should we, something we should worry about?
I wouldn't worry about it. There's nothing you can do about it in any event.
Is this useless science, or is this something that actually now the planners in Washington should start worrying about, not
no.
just Iraq and Iran, but they should worry about the expanding universe?
Well, I think it's not useless. It's just not practical. That's all.
Right.
And these ideas really matter. People care about them.
And was there a eureka moment for you that Hubble allowed you to have? You thought, oh my goodness, I never imagined.
This was a big project that involved a lot of ground-based work done at lots of observatories. But there was a moment when Adam Rees, who had been my student and was then a postdoc, had been working on the data, and he wrote me a note and he said, look, it looks as if the universe is expanding faster and faster, not slower. And I wrote back in an email, I said, in your heart, you know this is wrong, because we'd been telling each other for the last 70 years or so, ever since Einstein sort of thought of this idea and then said, oh, that was a bad idea, my greatest blunder. For 70 years, we've been telling ourselves that what we really were going to measure was the slowing down of the universe. And what we found, and the Hubble was a big part of that, was that the universe is actually speeding up. So we had to let go of what we knew for sure and to let the facts speak for themselves.
Well, I'm glad we all know about this now. Let's see what our Connection listeners think about all this. Kaveh is calling us on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. Kaveh, welcome. What would you like to say about this?
Thank you. I actually have studied astrophysics with one degree, and the other degree is business administration. I did undergraduate research at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics on the Astro Project, which is a submillimeter telescope in Antarctica, basically in the infrared. So as an amateur astronomer in the business world, I had a couple questions which I was wondering maybe we're not looking at. One is, I understand the benefits of the Hubble Space Telescope and the unification of the astronomy industry in the world. Second, I fully understand the benefits of the Webb's telescope and infrared, because in a sense it helps astronomers see the nebulae and the galaxies better than the visual, which is what the Hubble Space Telescope does. One is, I was wondering, is there a way to salvage both? Is there a grassroots campaign? It seems here the cost-benefit, astronomers are tremendous business people to find grants for such a interesting topic. However, is there a way to be able to maybe get a grassroots campaign going to help fund both? And second of all, are there other instruments available to be able to do what the Hubble Space Telescope is doing to help maybe amateur astronomers enter the field a little bit?
Great questions, Kaveh. I hope you don't need a degree in astrophysics to ask them. But let me start first with that, with your suggestion about a mass grassroots campaign. Jim O'Leary, did it ever occur to you to do that?
Well, I guess this is something that's come up relatively recently, although it's been discussed over time. When Hubble was first launched in 1990, I think its original lifetime was geared for 10 years, and we've obviously bypassed that. It's moved up to 15, and there's some question now of keeping it at least until the James Webb Space Telescope comes online, which is pegged for launch in 2011, although that slips a year at a time because of budgets and technical issues. So if now the discussion is that Hubble, or the discussion had been that Hubble and James Webb may overlap for a while, so there is that continuity. But if Hubble is brought down earlier, I think now all of a sudden the public is hearing that, gee, there could be a demise of Hubble, even though it's 6, 7, 8 years in the future. We haven't really heard much of that hue and cry yet, but I think that might be out there. I think what was just the meeting that happened in Washington these past weeks and some of the articles that have appeared about it indicate there's an interest in saving the spacecraft. But what you find, I think, is that it's really a very practical argument. The Hubble Space Telescope operations was going to slowly merge into the James Webb Space Telescope operations, and therefore the budget lines in NASA would become complementary, where one would move into the other, Hubble would go away, James Webb would take its place, not just scientifically, but in the budget line as well. Operating both telescopes or keeping Hubble Space Telescope in orbit around the Earth longer just means more money. And where is that going to come from, out of the Webb Space Telescope or someplace else? So it's a very practical discussion that NASA has to have.
Exactly. And Robert Kirshen, do you worry there may be a gap between the two telescopes and really it would be at a huge cost?
Well, there's a group of very wise people who have been charged with advising NASA on what to do. Astronomers get together every 10 years and figure out what our priorities are. And we said we really want that thing beyond the space telescope, which is the James Webb Space Telescope. So we really want that.
You don't want to keep the Hubble.
I didn't say that, did I? No. And so the question is, how do you get from here to there? And what should the end game for the Hubble Space Telescope be? There's going to be an end game eventually. And one new factor is that, of course, the telescope has to be brought out of orbit safely. You can't just let a big thing like that fall where it will. It could injure somebody. And so that means we have to figure out a plan to go up to the space telescope and attach some kind of little rocket that can be used to bring the telescope down when the time comes. The question is really, since you have to go up anyway to do that, wouldn't it be a good idea, or is, you know, we should consider the possibility of making one new instrument, taking that up there, boosting the space telescope as high as you can with the shuttle, and then running it for as long as it can be profitably used before the James Webb Space Telescope is ready, and to really use that wonderful capability that we've got from the Hubble Space Telescope as long as we can do it. So it's a question, as James said, of using the resources wisely and trying to figure out what the right thing to do is. And it may turn out that the decision of this group of wise people will be something like what I just said, or it may be something different, in which case we'll have to talk
to
them again.
Let's hope there's lots of wisdom around, and our connection listeners have wisdom too, and they want to share it with us. Joseph is on the line from Nashua, New Hampshire. Joseph, welcome. What do you want to say about the Hubble?
Well, I think I'm coming at it from a slightly different take. By the way, thank you for taking my call. My thinking is that the Hubble has presented us with a true bridge, or is presenting us with a true bridge between science and the humanities. And the reason I say that, and the reason I think something should be done to save the Hubble in some way, is I remember vividly the pictures of the asteroid crashing into Jupiter, or the meteors, whatever they were, crashing into Jupiter. And I believe because of that, because of seeing those objects crash into the biggest planet in our solar system, destroying the red spot, which to me was this mythic thing that I remember reading about from childhood, it really gave me a sense of I'll use the term mythic, of the vastness, the greatness, more than anything else, more than seeing distant galaxies, more than seeing, you know, far distant objects, because here was something which is our neighbor in space, the biggest thing. It's vulnerable. And I'm not trying to be alarmist. I'm not saying, oh my gosh, we should worry about asteroids here. What I'm saying is the Hubble showed us for the first time what space is, really, what it's like up there. And that, to me, allowed me to have a better perspective of my place, my existence, my being. And to me, that's a humanities issue. I wouldn't have that, though, if the Hubble had not shown us those pictures.
Thank you, Joseph, for giving us that amazing story about that sort of mythic event, as you called it. Does that mean you want to keep Hubble around? You're not confident I think Joseph has left us from Nashua, New Hampshire, and he mentioned that extraordinary crash in the sky, and you can actually see it as well on www.theconnection.org, where there's a whole bunch of mythic events taking place as we speak. Well, let's now take another caller on the line. David is on the line from Wellesley, Massachusetts. David, what do you want to say about Hubble?
Hello, I wanted to ask your astronomer guests to tell us a little bit about Edwin F. Hubble, who is the astronomer after whom the telescope is named. And what little I know about it, I think it was a very appropriate choice of names.
Well, let's see whether Jim O'Leary really is a science educator. Do you know much about Edwin Hubble?
Sure, he's a former boxer. Isn't that an interesting story?
That's great.
And a lawyer to some extent, too. But he found his calling and his love in astronomy. And when he was doing his work, there really wasn't a good understanding of the scale of the universe. One of the things that we could look at in the sky that amateur astronomers know well, and you can actually see by eye if you have a nice dark sky, is something called the Andromeda Galaxy, which is another galaxy similar to ours, containing several hundred billion stars, like the sun, bigger or smaller than the sun, but stars of one kind or another. And it's in the northern sky certain times of the year. You can actually, even though it's that large, you can put your fingertip up and cover it in the sky. It's so far away. It's about 2 million light years away. That galaxy was known as the Andromeda Nebula at Hubble's time, and nobody really knew that it was a distant galaxy. And what Hubble did is he understood with his research that he did at Mount Wilson in California that the universe is expanding. Like Robert was talking about before, we've known the universe is, we know the universe has been expanding since the Big Bang, but he sort of confirmed that this Big Bang, this huge explosion, has thrown all the elements, the parts of the universe out, racing away from each other. And Hubble is the first to sort of be able to confirm that for us, and it's one of those great milestones in our understanding of how the universe works, where the universe came from, and possibly where the universe might be heading.
Well done, Jim O'Leary. David, has Edwin Hubble changed your life in any way? Did you have a mythic event, as we heard from our last caller?
Well, I'm 56 years old, and when I was 6 years old, which, if my math is right, was a half a century ago, I was out in the backyard with my big brother looking at the skies and having some of these things explained to me. And I believe some of the things that Hubble was discovering on Mount Wilson, which, incidentally, I could see from my backyard in Pasadena, were opening up all these visions of what we saw in the sky actually meant. And I didn't know about Hubble at the time, but later on, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe he was even on the cover of Time magazine one time.
Yes, he was, yeah. And he died right around the same time you're talking about, 1953, I believe. So
yeah, so he became kind of a mythic figure to all us little kids who were excited about astronomy.
Well, David, thank you for sharing some of your excitement with us on the line from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Robert Kirshner, you approach this as a scientist, but we're hearing from our callers it's almost at the point where science meets divinity and existential moments. Do you still have those when you look into the skies, and especially through tell us with the means that you can see as sharply and clearly as possible?
Well, I think the scientists go about their own agenda. That is, we're trying to find out how these things, what these things are, how they work, how they've changed over time, and we're using this very powerful tool to do it. So live in an expanding universe, and we want to know how long it's been expanding and how the chemical abundances have changed over time due to the explosions of stars, that sort of thing. But these are such big questions, and these are set kind of so deeply into kind of who we are as people that by just going about our business as scientists, where the agenda is set by what the scientific questions and opportunities are, I think we're going to touch on a lot of the things that the listeners have been talking about, the visual excitement and the intellectual excitement, thrilling ideas that take you out of yourself and your kind of little daily world.
And off the planet.
And you're right. I mean, you know,
you have a bigger world than we do because you're always looking up there billions of years into the sky.
Exactly. And if you know, people are so short that when we look to the horizon, we only see a couple miles away. And this kind of takes you out of that sort of self-centered world and into something that's asking the question, never mind you for a moment, you know, what's out there and how is it organized? Because it's not organized according to human principles or desires. You know, it's a natural thing whose aspects we're just beginning to discover.
Jim O'Leary, are you also awed and humbled by this? Feel a bit short?
Oh, I never thought of it quite that way, but yes, indeed. I mean, you think about what Hubble has done in terms of just the sheer beauty of the images, which is where a lot of the public connects with the telescope. And what Hubble has been able to do, just because of its position above the atmosphere, which is a great plus, it's not very far away. It's only a few hundred miles away, but it's got that advantage of being above the troublesome atmosphere. But also because of its instruments and how far it can see and how clearly it can see, it gives us these amazing views that astronomers and scientists, of course, are saying, my goodness, look at this. It's the first time we've ever seen fill in the blank. And it's about the history of the universe, how stars are formed, that black holes exist, that quasars power galaxies, whatever it might be. But these advances happen, I think, when you have these giant steps in technology. And you can go back as far as Galileo when he actually took this new invention of the telescope and turned it to the skies, and all of a sudden we saw things we never saw before. Hubble is a similar leap in what we see and what we understand.
Change the way in which we look at our world and beyond. We're talking about space and science and awesome myth moments. Join us to hear us talk about what the Hubble Space Telescope has done to transform the way we look at the universe. Connection listeners, do you know how old the universe is? Can you tell us why stars explode? What questions do you have that you still want answered? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Lise Doucette in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on Ground Earth on NPR. I'm Lise Doucette in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, and we have a very, very special program. We're talking at the place where science meets art and outer space. We're talking about the Hubble Space Telescope. Has it transformed the world in which you live? Has it made the world, the universe, even bigger, even clearer to all of you? Our guests are Jim O'Leary, co-host of the radio program Skywatch, a technology director of the Maryland Science Center, and with me in the studio, Robert Kirshner, author of The Extravagant Universe. And we're finding out it's not so extravagant at all. We can actually see it ourselves. Tell us what you think. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And our first caller here on planet Earth is Mike from Waltham, Massachusetts. Welcome, Mike. Has the Hubble done anything to your life?
Well, thank you for having me. Well, it's an amazing accomplishment, and particularly putting the correction in. And that just flabbergasted me. That was just an amazing thing. My question, though, has to do with you're talking about the far reaches of this and gathering light from the end of the universe. I'm wondering, what's the near focus here? Is the Hubble capable of, you know, taking a look at the moon, taking a look at Earth, taking a look at, say, asteroids in near-Earth orbit or anything like that?
Good question, Mike. I'm going to put it to the scientist, Robert Kirshner.
Well, the Hubble Space Telescope has certainly been used to study objects in the solar system. And that's one of the things that's so interesting about astronomy in general and observatories, but Hubble in particular, is that you build a telescope and you get a set of instruments, and then you can use it on a very, very wide range of problems. And in this case, as one caller mentioned, the comet that crashed into Jupiter, but there are also studies of what's happening on planets, and also finding out about planets around other stars. So there are lots of things that can be done in the sort of near universe, in our own solar system, or about stars in our own galaxy using the Hubble Space Telescope. So it's a very versatile instrument.
There's also...
Can it, in fact, focus on the surface of the Earth through the atmosphere?
The Earth is pretty bright. And, the daylight,
the cities that never sleep.
There was an image that was taken of the moon not too long ago, and that was a bit of a challenge early on because, like Robert said, the Earth, the sun and the moon are typically too bright for Hubble, and it's meant to look at sensitive objects. But with some clever engineering, there was an image taken of a famous part of the moon, the crater Copernicus, and its surrounding area. But that's probably the closest image it's taken. And, of course, it took pictures of the comet that hit Jupiter. And it's taking ongoing pictures of the planets. It's almost giving us these regular weather reports of what's going on the planets, from storms in the atmosphere of Saturn to changes in the cloud belts of Jupiter to the changes that the Shoemaker-Levy comet caused when it hit Jupiter. And just to dispel any rumors that the Great Red Spot has disappeared, that is still there, that wasn't sort of disrupted by Shoemaker-Levy hitting into it, but it did cause some effects that we could see right here on Earth, even through backyard telescopes.
Jim O'Dear, you're pretending to be a radio presenter, but I think you're an astrophysicist really in disguise. Let's take another caller. Frank is on the line from Greensboro in North Carolina. Frank, what do you want to tell us about the Hubble telescope?
Well, you remember back in the 60s when we used to crash rockets into the moon and take photographs on its way down?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I was about 11, I was up early one morning with my little 3-inch telescope hoping to see it hit, and of course I didn't see anything. Mm-hmm. But that was one of my mythic moments missed. But I was just wondering, if the Hubble is coming down due to lack of, energy, couldn't we, get two birds for the price of one by putting it into a higher orbit and at the same time get practice doing that when something like that might be an emergency?
Yeah, Robert, you were talking about this earlier, but let me bring in one point, because someone said actually that it would take a lot longer to do that, and it might actually put some astronauts' lives at risk. Tell us
every,
a bit more.
Every time they've gone up, I believe that they've been able to use the shuttle to raise the orbit of the Hubble Space Telescope. So when astronauts have gone up in the shuttle for servicing missions, they've boosted the orbit a little bit to counteract the effects of drag. The atmosphere kind of slows the orbit down and makes it fall in. There is a mission, another servicing mission, that we hope will take place in 2005, depending a little on how quickly the shuttle gets going. There are a couple of new instruments to go in, and they will boost it up. And what we're really talking about is the one after that. What's going to happen in 2010, where the original plan was to send the shuttle up and bring the Hubble Space Telescope back to Earth and maybe hang it in the Air and Space Museum on the Mall. Well, I think after this recent disaster, nobody wants to risk the lives of astronauts for that. But the astronauts are very clear that they would really like to do something that serves a big idea, something that makes science go forward. They would love to go up and fix the Hubble Space Telescope, or put a new instrument on it, or boost it up, and have it run out as long as it can. And maybe that's what this fifth mission, the mission in 2010, will look like. The people have to figure out what the limitations are and try to see if that's practical.
It'll still be in perfect working condition, though. It's just that the altitude is falling?
Well, it's like an old car. Pieces wear out. It has batteries, for example, that have to be replaced. There are the solar panels have been replaced twice. We've got the good ones now. The one piece that seems a little vulnerable are the gyroscopes that help it point very, very accurately at stars. And those seem to last for a while, but then they get a little flaky and have to be replaced. So the astronauts have brought up lots of new parts to keep the telescope going. But more than that, they've also boosted the telescope. And beyond that, they've brought some new instruments that make it like a whole new observatory after each of these missions.
Frank, thank you so much for calling in. And we're sorry you missed your mythic moment with your 3-inch telescope. But hopefully there's been many more opportunities. Joe now is on the line from Greensboro, North Carolina. Joe.
Hi. I'm an astronomer. I keep track of the physical universe through Astronomy Magazine and Scientific American. I try to promote other people's awareness of what's going on and how vast the universe is. I'm new to the South, to North Carolina, and I noticed that whenever I talk about things like this, I bump into people's religious beliefs as, you know, for instance, how could the universe be 6 billion years old when the Earth is only 6,000 years old? And I wondered how your guests might help me answer those questions and address that issue. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Oh, goodness, we don't have any religious experts here, but Jim O'Leary, he seems to be an expert on everything. Jim, do you want to answer?
Oh, well, gee, thanks, Lise. that is a tricky one. I mean, that, you know, you're bumping between, you know, the research of science and what it shows us about the universe. And you know, the scientific research method has it requires us to go out there and observe and make observations and make assumptions and then try to prove or disprove those assumptions to come up with theories and understandings of how the universe and anything else works, from our human body to atoms. You put that up against you know, religious beliefs, if there are beliefs that say that the Earth is only 6,000 years old, and that's dogma, well, that's what folks will believe. And there's ways I think science and religion can cohabit with each other, but I guess an open mind is required.
But it's a tough field, though, isn't it? Because ever since the days of Galileo, religion and science have been fighting each other. Robert, what do you say to that?
Well, people always ask me these questions if I give a public lecture.
But they're very important questions.
Well, they are, but it seems to me...
Don't dismiss them.
No, it's a little bit the wrong thing, because the physical world, what we can do is describe the physical world, and that's what we're trying to do.
But they would say, of course, it's something beyond the physical world.
Yeah, but does that tell you how to behave? Or how to be a good person, or what is a good life, or how to treat other people? No, it doesn't. I know this because I know a lot of astronomers. And the fact is that understanding the physical world is a very interesting, intricate, complicated, challenging thing.
Robert Kirchner, you're avoiding the question now.
Absolutely, but it's not the same thing, and I think it doesn't tell you anything about questions of faith.
Jim, I think you want to come in again.
Well, Robert is saying is right. I mean, there are ways that we can observe the universe, and that's what science is about. I mean, there's the whole discussion about creation science, which is about as much as putting the round peg into the square hole as you can imagine. Because I mean, there are scientific beliefs which are based on observation, going out and looking, and what do I see? And that's where Galileo got into trouble. You mentioned him before. He took the telescope, turned it toward the sky, and saw changes in the celestial sphere, which had been indicated dogmatically before that the celestial sphere is perfect and does not change, therefore you are a heretic. And that's always been a bit of an issue. But Robert's right.
Let me say it more strongly then.
Very briefly.
It seems to me the realm of questions where you say, oh, you can't ask that question, that's not a question for science to study, that realm has been shrinking over time. And so it's not clear that we should rule out questions that seem like they belong in some other bin from astronomical and physical investigation, like where did the universe come from?
Well, even if it's shrinking here in the connection, we'd like to ask all the questions out there. We're going to take a question or a comment from Newton, Massachusetts. Nelson is joining the conversation. Welcome, Nelson. What would you like to say?
Yes, very quickly, just to throw a little cold water on the whole thing. The space shuttle, the telescope, the platform. There's a fellow named Robert Zubrin who has suggested that we go to Mars direct, just as we went to the moon, and perhaps we could have taken all this money, which is an enormous amount of money, tremendous amount. Perhaps we're just playing around and gone to Mars. I wonder if they'd comment on that.
Well, Nelson, do stay on the line, because I want to ask you about Hubble, too. But Robert Kirchner, so it's really not the point. Let's go to Mars instead.
Well, I think there are two threads of space work. One is space science, using the fact that you're above the atmosphere and you can make these beautiful telescopes to measure X-rays, measure ultraviolet, measure infrared, stuff that you cannot do from the Earth, and to explore the universe from our location using the fact that we're above the atmosphere. That's one thread. And then the other one, which the caller is talking about, is really manned exploration of space. And that's what the space station is about, and that's sort of what's in the back of people's minds is going to Mars or going somewhere. That's a vastly more expensive enterprise than the space science enterprise, but it's certainly something where NASA has put a lot of its energy.
Jim?
What Zubrin has done, Nelson has a good point that Zubrin is talking about a truly bold mission to go to Mars like we did to the moon in the early, mid, late 60s. And a lot of folks see the space station really as a detour. It can be seen as a step because there's a lot of experimentation going on, both in how humans adapt to long-term space travel. And there's some science as well, but with the reduced amount of astronauts that are currently on board the station because of the Columbia accident and other reasons, there's a lot less science going on than people had hoped for originally. Now, that will grow over time, we hope. But the ability to go to Mars is would have to be a large international effort. No country, the United States or Russia, could afford to do that by themselves. So it's an awful lot of organizational ability and an awful lot of money.
Indeed. Jim O'Leary, we promised our listeners we'd take them to places they've never been before. I want to bring this down to earth. I understand you have a poetry project, such as the greatness that Hubble has inspired.
Yes, we do. Yeah, we were able to acquire a grant from NASA, from their educational division, and do a program at our science center that's called Hubble Heritage Poetic Pictures. And there's a collection of images on the Hubble website. It's known as Hubble Heritage. And this team, led by Keith Knoll at Space Telescope Science Institute, picks out an image a month. They've been doing this for about 4 or 5 years now, and there's about 50 images in that archive. So you can click onto that very easily, the Heritage Project from the Hubble site. And these are, like you were saying earlier, Elise, these are a good example of the mixture of art and science. What they do is they take beautiful images and they post them on the website. And many of these are hidden in the archives. They were taken for scientific research purposes and the science has been done, but there are literally hundreds of thousands of Hubble images. So they've gone through there and mined the archives and pulled out these beautiful pictures. So what we have done is we introduced a group of Baltimore City high school students to the Hubble Heritage site, asked them to choose one of their favorites and write some poetry based on that image. A dozen or so of these students did that, high school students, and we transformed it into a presentation in our planetarium where we brought the images alive in very artistic and dramatic ways and had the students read their poetry eventually turned that into a program that's offered to our public on a daily basis.
Well, let's hope this inspires our Connection listeners to write poems. And this music reminds us, of course, there's been great films inspired by outer space as well. I think we have to do better than Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, How I Wonder What You Are. Thank you to all our Connection listeners today for calling in and telling us where you are with the Hubble. Thanks to Jim O'Leary, Senior Director of IMAX Planetarium at the Maryland Science Center, also a radio presenter, colleague. Robert Kirshner, author of The Extravagant Universe. We also heard earlier from Rick Feinberg, Editor-in-Chief of Sky and Telescope magazine. You've been listening to The Connection. The senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Lise Doucette. Thank you for going with us beyond the bounds of planet Earth.